president's shelter. Kuropatkin lifted his phone. I need to talk to the president. Yes, General, what is it? Narmanov asked. We have indications of American air activity over Germany. There's more than that. A guards regiment in Berlin reports being under attack by American troops. That's mad. And the report came in not 5 minutes after my friend Fowler promised not to do anything provocative. Speak quickly. I have enough business here already. President Narmanov, 2 weeks ago a squadron of American F-117A stealth fighters arrived at their Ramstein Air Base, ostensibly for demonstration to their NATO allies. The Americans said they want to sell them. Each of those aircraft can carry 2 half-megaton weapons. Yes? I cannot detect them. They are virtually invisible to everything we have. What are you telling me? From the time they leave their bases, then refuel, they can be over Moscow in less than 3 hours. We would have no more warning than Iraq had. Are they truly that effective? One reason we left so many people in Iraq was to observe closely what the Americans are capable of. Our people never saw that American plane on a radar scope, neither ours nor the French scopes Saddam had. Yes, they are that good. But why would they wish to do such a thing? Narmanov demanded. Why would they attack our regiment in Berlin? The defense minister asked in reply. I thought this place was proof against anything in their arsenal. Not against a nuclear gravity bomb delivered with high accuracy. We are only 100 meters down here, defense said. In the old battle between warhead and armor, warhead always wins. Back to Berlin, Narmanov said. Do we know what's happening there? No. What we have has come from junior officers only. Get someone in there to find out. Tell our people to fall back if they can do so safely, and take defensive action only. Do you object to that? No. That is prudent. The National Photographic Intelligence Center, NPIC, is located at the Washington Navy Yard in one of several windowless buildings housing highly sensitive government activities. At the moment, they had a total of 3 KH-11 photographic and 2 KH-12 LaCrosse radar imaging satellites in orbit. At 0:26:46 seconds Zulu time, one of the 11s came within optical range of Denver. All of its cameras zoomed in on the city, especially its southern suburbs. The images were downlinked in real time to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and sent from there to NPIC by fiber optic cable. At NPIC, they were recorded in 2-inch videotape. Analysis started immediately. This aircraft was a DC-10. Cotty and Gone again availed themselves of first-class seating, pleased and amazed at their good luck. The word had gotten out only minutes before the flight was called. As soon as the report had gone out on the Reuters wire, it had been inevitable. AP and UPI had instantly picked it up, and all television stations subscribed to the wire services. Surprised that the networks had not yet put out their own special bulletins, the local affiliates ran with it anyway. The one thing about it that had surprised Cotty was the silence. As the word spread like a wave through the terminal building, what lay behind it was not shouting and panic, but an eerie silence that allowed one to hear the flight calls and other background noises normally submerged by the cacophony of voices in such public areas. So the Americans faced tragedy and death, the commander thought. The lack of passion surprised him. It was soon behind him in any case. The DC-10 accelerated down the runway and lifted off. A few minutes later, it was over international waters, heading toward a neutral country and safety. One more connection, both men thought in a silence of their own. One more connection, and they would disappear completely. Who would have expected such luck? The infrared emissions are remarkable, the photo analyst thought aloud. It was his first nuclear detonation. I have damage and secondary fires up to a mile from the stadium. Not much of the stadium itself. Too much smoke and IR interference. Next pass, if we're lucky, we ought to have some visible light imagery. What can you tell us about casualty count? Ryan asked. What I have is inconclusive. Mainly, the visible light shots show smoke that's obscuring everything. Infrared levels are very impressive. Lots of fires immediately around the stadium itself. Cars, I guess. Gas tanks cooking off. Jack turned to the senior science and technology officer. Who do we have up in the photo section? Nobody, S&T replied. Weekend, remember? We let NPIC handle weekend work unless we expect something hot. Who's the best guy? Andy Davis. But he lives in Manassas. He'll never make it in. God damn it. Ryan picked up the phone again. Send us the best 10 photos you have, he told NPIC. You'll have them in 2 or 3 minutes. How about someone to evaluate the bomb effects? I can do that, S&T said. Ex-Air Force. I used to work intel for SAC. Run with it. The 9 Abrams tanks had by now accounted for nearly 30 of the Russian T-80s. The Soviets had pulled south to find cover of their own. Their return fire had killed 3 more of the M1A1s, but now the odds were a lot more even. The captain commanding the tank detachment sent his Bradleys east to conduct reconnaissance. As with their first dash, there were people watching them, but for the most part they did this from windows now unlit. The streetlights worried one Bradley commander, who took a rifle and began shooting them out, to the horror of Berliners, who had the courage to watch. Was nun? Keitel asked. What now? Now we get the devil away from here and disappear. Our work is done, Bach replied, turning the wheel to the left. A northerly escape route seemed best. They'd dump the car and truck, change their clothes, and vanish. They might even survive all this, Bach thought. Wouldn't that be something? But his main thought was that he'd avenged his Petra. It had been the Americans and Russians who'd brought her death about. Germans had only been the pawns of the great players, and the great players were paying now, Bach told himself, were paying now and would pay more. Revenge wasn't so cold a dish, after all, was it? Russian staff car, the gunner said, and a GAZ truck. Chain gun. The track commander took his time identifying the inbound targets. Wait. I love killing officers. The gunner centered the sight for his 25-millimeter cannon. On target, Sarge. For all his experience as a terrorist, Bach was not a soldier. He took the dark, square shape 2 blocks away for a large truck. His plan had worked. The American alert, so perfectly timed, could only mean that Cotty and Gone had done their job exactly as he'd envisioned 5 months earlier. His eyes shifted as he saw what looked like a flashbulb and a streak of light that went over his head. Fire! Hose 'em! The gunner had his selector switch on rapid fire. The 25-millimeter chain gun was wonderfully accurate, and the tracers allowed you to walk fire right into the target. The first long burst hit the truck. There might, he reasoned, be armed soldiers in the truck. The initial rounds went into the engine block, shattering it into fragments. Then, as the vehicle surged forward, the next burst swept through the cab and cargo area. The truck collapsed on 2 flattened front tires and ground to a halt, the wheel rims digging grooves in the asphalt. By that time, the gunner had shifted fire and put a short burst through the staff car. This target merely lost control and slammed into a parked BMW. Just to make sure, the gunner hit the car again, and then the truck. Someone actually got out of the truck, probably wounded already from the way he moved. 2 more 25-millimeter rounds fixed that. The track commander moved immediately. One does not linger where one has killed. 2 minutes later, they found another surveillance spot. Police cars were racing down the streets, their blue lights flashing. One of them stopped a few hundred meters from the Bradley, backed up and raced off, the track commander saw. Well, he'd always known German cops were smart. 5 minutes after the Bradley departed for another block, the first Berliner, an exceedingly courageous physician, came out his front door and went to the staff car. Both men were dead, each torso ripped to shreds by the cannon shells, though both faces were intact except for the splashed blood. The truck was an even greater mess. One of the men there might have survived for a few minutes, but by the time the doctor got there, it was far too late. He found it odd that they all wore Russian officers' uniforms. Not knowing what else to do, he called the police. Only later did he realize how disproportionate his understanding of the events outside his home had been. They weren't kidding about the infrared signature. This must have been some bomb, the S&T guy observed. Damage is a little funny, though. Huh. What do you mean, Ted? Ryan asked. I mean the ground damage ought to be worse than this. Must be shadows and reflections. He looked up. Sorry. Shock waves don't go through things. Like a hill, I mean. There must have been reflections and shadows here, that's all. These houses here ought not to be there anymore. I still don't know what you mean, Ryan said. There are always anomalies in cases like this. I'll get back to you when I have this figured out, okay? Ted Ayers asked. Walter Hoskins sat in his office because he didn't know what else to do, and as most senior men present, he had to answer the phones. All he needed to do was turn to see what the stadium was. The pall of smoke was only 5 miles away through his windows, one of which was cracked. Part of him wondered if he should send a team down there, but he had no such orders. He turned his chair to look that way again, amazed that the window was almost intact. After all, it was supposed to have been a nuclear bomb, and it was only 5 miles. The remains of the cloud were now over the front range of the Rockies, still intact enough that you could tell what it had been. And behind it, like a wake, was another black plume of fires from the bomb area. The destruction must be... not enough. Not enough? What a crazy thought. With nothing else to do, Hoskins lifted the phone and dialed up Washington. Give me Murray. Yeah, Walt. How busy are you? Not very, as a matter of fact. How is it at your end? We have the TV stations and phones shut down. I hope the president will be there when I have to explain that one to the judge. Walt, this isn't the time. Not why I called. Well, then you want to tell me? I can see it from here, Dan, Hoskins said in a voice that was almost dreamy. How bad is it? All I see is the smoke, really. The mushroom cloud is over the mountains now, all orange-like. Sunset. It's high enough to catch the sunset, I guess. I can see lots of little fires. They're lighting up the smoke from the stadium area. Dan? Yeah, Walt, Dan responded. The man seemed to be in shock, Murray thought. Something odd. What's that? My windows aren't broken. I'm only like 5 miles from there, and only one of my windows is cracked even. Odd, isn't it? Hoskins paused. I have some stuff here that you said you wanted. Pictures and stuff. Hoskins leafed through the documents that had been set in his in-basket. Marvin Russell sure picked a busy day to die. Anyway, I have the passport stuff you wanted. Important? It can wait. Okay. Hoskins hung up. Walt's losing it, Pat, Murray observed. You blame him? O'Day asked. Dan shook his head. No. If this gets worse, Pat observed. How far out is your family? Not far enough. 5 miles, Murray said quietly. What? Walt said that his office is just 5 miles away. He can see it from there. His windows aren't broken even. Bullshit, O'Day replied. He must really be out of it. 5 miles? That's less than 9,000 yards. What do you mean? Nora had said the bomb was 100 kiloton range. That'll break windows over a hell of a long distance. Only takes half a pound or so of overpressure to do a window. How do you know? Used to be in the Navy. Intelligence, remember? I had to evaluate the damage distances for Russian tactical nukes once. 100 kiloton bomb at 9,000 yards won't sink you, but it'll wreck everything topside. Scorch paint, start small fires. Bad news, man. Curtains, like? Ought to, O'Day thought aloud. Yeah, regular curtains would light up, especially if they're dark ones. Walt's not so far out of it that he'd miss a fire in his office. Murray lifted his phone to Langley. Yeah, what is it, Dan? Jack said into the speaker. What number do you have on the size of the explosion? According to NORAD, 150, maybe 200 kilotons. Size of a big tactical weapon or a small strategic one, Ryan said. Why? On the other side of the table, the S&T officer looked up from the photos. I just talked to my ASAC Denver. He can see the stadium area from his office. 5 miles, Jack. He's only got one cracked window.
Bull,
S&T noted. What do you mean? Ryan asked. 5 miles. That's 8,000 meters, Ted Ayers pointed out. The thermal pulse alone should fry the place, and the shockwave would sure as hell blow a plate glass window out. Murray heard that. Yeah, that's what a guy here just said. Hey, my guy might be a little out of it. Shock, I mean. But he'd notice a fire next to his desk, don't you think? Do we have anything from people on the scene yet? Jack asked Ayers. No, the Nest team is on the way, but the imagery tells us a lot, Jack. Dan, how quick can you get somebody to the scene? Ryan asked. I'll find out. Hoskins, Dan Murray, Walt. Get some people down there fast as you can. You stay put to coordinate. Okay. Hoskins gave the proper orders, wondering just how badly he might be endangering his people. Then, with nothing else to do, he looked over the file on his desk. Marvin Russell, he thought. Yet another criminal who died of dumb. Drug dealers. Didn't they ever learn? Roger Durling was grateful when the kneecap aircraft disengaged from the tanker. The converted 747 had the usual pussycat ride, but not when in close proximity to a KC-10 tanker. It was something only his son enjoyed. Aboard in the conference room were an Air Force brigadier, a Navy captain, a Marine major, and 4 other field and staff-grade officers. All the data the president got came to kneecap automatically, including the hotline transcripts. You know, what they're saying is okay, but it sure as hell would be nice to know what everyone's thinking. What if this really is a Russian attack? The general asked. Why would they do it? You've heard the chatter between the president and CIA, sir. Yeah, but that Ryan guy's right, Durling said. None of this makes any sense. So whoever said the world had to make sense? What about the contact in the Med in Berlin? Forward deployed forces. We go on alert, and they go on alert, and they're close to each other, and someone goofs. You know, like Gavrilo Princip shooting the Archduke. An accident happens, and then things just slide down the chute. That's why we have the hotline, Mr. Vice President. True, Durling conceded. And so far, it seems to be working. They made the first 50 yards easily, but then it got harder, and soon it went from hard to impossible. Callahan had a total of 50 firefighters trying to fight their way on, with 100 more in support. On reflection, he had a continuous water spray over every man and woman. If nothing else, he reasoned, it would wash whatever fallout or dust or whatever the hell was out here off his people and into the sewer drains. That which didn't freeze first, that is. The men in front were coated with ice that made a translucent layer on their turnout coats. The biggest problem was the cars. They'd been tossed about like toys, lying on their sides or tops, leaking gasoline that collected into burning puddles that were being supplied faster than they burned off. Callahan ordered a truck in. One at a time, his men ran cables to the frames of the wrecked cars, and the truck dragged them clear. But this was horribly time-consuming. It would take forever to get into the stadium. And there were people in there. He was sure of it. There had to be. Callahan just stood there, out of the water spray, guilty that he was warmer than his people. He turned when he heard the roar of a large diesel engine. Hello? It was a man wearing the uniform of a U.S. Army colonel. The name tag on his parka read Lyle. I hear you need heavy equipment. What you got? I have 3 engineer tanks, M728s, just rolling in now. Got something else, too.
What's that?
100 mop suits, you know, chemical warfare gear. It ain't perfect, but it's better than what your people got on.
Warmer, too. Why don't you pull your people off and get them outfitted? Truck's over there.
The colonel pointed. Callahan hesitated for a moment, but decided that he couldn't turn this offer down. He called his people off and pulled them back to don the military gear. Colonel Lyle tossed him an outfit.
The water fog's a good idea. Ought to keep dust and stuff down.
So what do you want us to do?
You can't tell from here, but there is still some structure in there. I think there might be survivors. I have to find out. Can you help us get through these cars?
Sure. The colonel lifted his own radio and ordered the first vehicle in. The M728, Callahan saw, was essentially a tank with a dozer blade on the front and a big A-frame and winch on the back of the turret. There was even an odd-looking short-barreled gun.
This isn't going to be very neat. Can you live with that?
Screw neat! Get in there!
Okay.
Lyle picked up the interphone at the left rear of the vehicle. Make a hole, he ordered. The driver revved up the diesel just as the first fireman returned. He made a sincere effort to avoid the fire hoses. Even so, he split 8 2.5-inch lines. The blade dropped and the tank crashed into the mass of burning cars at 20 miles per hour. It made a hole, all right, about 30 feet deep. Then the tank backed off and started widening it.
Jesus, Callahan observed. What do you know about radiation stuff?
Not much. I checked with the Nest guys before I drove down. They ought to be here any time.
Until then,
Lyle shrugged.
You really think there's live ones in there?
Part of the structure is still there. I saw it from the chopper.
No shit?
Yeah, I saw it.
But that's crazy.
The NORAD guys say it was a big one.
What?
Callahan shouted over the noise of the tank.
The bomb. It was supposed to be a big one. There shouldn't even be a parking lot here.
You mean this was a little one? Callahan looked at the man as though he were crazy.
Hell yes!
Lyle stopped for a moment. If there's people in there... He ran to the back of the tank and grabbed the phone. A moment later, the M728 stopped.
What's the matter?
If there are survivors, hell, we might squash one this way. I just told him to take it easier.
God damn, you're right.
And I thought you were crazy.
What do you mean?
Callahan shouted again, waving his firefighters to put their spray on the tank also.
There may be survivors in there. This bomb was a hell of a lot smaller than they told me on the phone.
Maine, this is Sea Devil 13, the P3C Orion called. We're about 40 minutes out from your position. What seems to be the problem?
We have screw and shaft damage, and we have an Akula in the neighborhood. Last fix, 50,000 yards southwest, Rex answered.
Roger that. We'll see if we can drive him off for you. We'll report when we get on station. Out.
Captain, we can do 3 knots. Let's do that, north. Open as much as we can, Claggett said.
Rex shook his head.
No, we'll stay quiet.
Sir, our friend out there must have copied the collision transient. He will be coming this way. We've lost our best sonar. Smart move is to evade as best we can.
No, the smart move is to stay covert.
Then at least launch a MOS.
That makes sense, sir, the weapons officer thought.
Okay, program it to sound like we are now, and give it a southerly course.
Right.
Maine's number 3 torpedo tube was loaded with a MOS, a mobile submarine simulator. Essentially a modified torpedo itself, the MOS contained a sonar transducer connected to a noise generator instead of a warhead. It would radiate the sound of an Ohio-class submarine and was designed to simulate a damaged one. Since shaft damage was one of the few reasons that an Ohio might make noise, that option was already programmed in. The weapons officer selected the proper noise track and launched the weapon a few minutes later. The MOS sped off to the south, and 2,000 yards away, it began radiating. The skies had cleared over Charleston, South Carolina. What had fallen as snow in Virginia and Maryland had been mainly sleet here. The afternoon sun had removed most of that, returning the antebellum city to its normally pristine state. As the admiral commanding Submarine Group 6 watched from the tender, two of his ballistic missile submarines started down the Cooper River for the sea and safety. He wasn't the only one to watch. 190 miles over his head, a Soviet reconnaissance satellite made its pass, continuing up the coast to Norfolk, where the sky was also clearing. The satellite downlinked its pictures to the Russian intelligence center on Cuba's western tip. From there, it was immediately relayed by communications satellite. Most of the Russian satellites used high polar orbits and had not been affected by the EMP. The imagery was in Moscow in a matter of seconds. "Yes," the defense minister asked. "We have imagery of 3 American naval bases. Missile submarines at Charleston and Kings Bay are put into sea." "Thank you." The defense minister replaced the phone. Another threat. He relayed it at once to President Narmanov. "What does that mean?" "It means that the military action taken by the Americans is not merely defensive. Some of the submarines in question carry the Trident D-5 missile, which has first strike capability. You'll recall how interested the Americans were in forcing us to eliminate our SS-18s. "Yes, and they are removing a large number of their Minutemen," Narmanov said. "So?" "So they don't need land-based missiles to make a first strike. They can do it from submarines. We cannot. We depend on our land-based ICBMs for that."
"And what of our SS-18s?
"We are removing the warheads from some of them even as we speak, and if they ever get that damn deactivation facility working, we'll be in full compliance with the treaty. We are now, in fact, just the damned Americans don't admit it."
The defense minister paused. Narmanov wasn't getting it.
"In other words, while we have eliminated some of our most accurate missiles, the Americans still have theirs. We are at a strategic disadvantage."
"I have not had much sleep, and my thinking is not at its best," Narmanov said testily.
"You agreed to this treaty document only a year ago, and now you're telling me that we are threatened by it."
"They're all the same," the defense minister thought. "They never listen. They never really pay attention. Tell them something 100 times and they just don't hear you."
"The elimination of so many missiles and warheads changes the correlation of forces."
"Rubbish! We are still equal in every way," President Narmanov objected.
"That is not the question. The important factor is the relationship between the number of launchers and their relative vulnerability and the number of warheads available to both sides. We can still strike first and eliminate the American land-based missile force with our land-based missiles. That is why they were so willing to remove half of theirs. But the majority of their warheads are at sea, and now, for the first time, such sea-based missiles are totally adequate for a disarming first strike."
"Kuropatkin," Narmanov said,
"are you hearing this?"
"Yes, I am. The defense minister is correct. The additional dimension, if I may say it, is that the reduction in the number of launchers has changed the overall ratio of launchers to warheads. For the first time in a generation, a truly disarming first strike is possible, especially if the Americans are able to decapitate our government with their first strike. and they could do that with the stealth fighters they put in Germany, Defense concluded the statement.
Wait a minute.
Are you telling me that Fowler blew up his own city as an excuse to attack us? What madness is this?
Now the Soviet president began to understand fear. The defense minister spoke slowly and clearly.
Whoever detonated that weapon is beside the point. If Fowler begins to think that it was our doing, he has the ability to act against us. Comrade President, you must understand this. Technically speaking, our country is on the edge of annihilation. Less than 30 minutes separate their land-based missiles from us, 20 minutes for their sea-based ones, and as little as 2 hours from those goddamned invisible tactical bombers, which would be the most advantageous opening move. All that separates us from destruction is the mental state of President Fowler.
I understand.
The Soviet president was quiet for half a minute. He stared off at the status board on the far wall. When he spoke, his voice showed the anger that comes from fright.
What do you propose we should do? Attack the Americans? I will not do such a thing.
Of course not, but we would be well advised to place our strategic forces on full alert. The Americans will take note of this and realize that a disarming attack is not possible, and we can settle this affair down long enough for reason to take hold.
Golovko?
The first deputy chairman of the KGB shrank from the inquiry.
We know that they are at full alert status. It is possible that our doing the same will provoke them. If we do not, we present ourselves as a much more inviting target.
The defense minister was inhumanly calm, perhaps the only man in the room who was fully in control of himself.
We know that the American president is under great stress, that he has lost many thousands of his citizens. He might lash out without thinking. He is much less likely to do so if he knows that we are in a position to respond in kind. We do not dare to show weakness at a time like this. Weakness always invites attack.
Narmanov looked around the room for a dissenting opinion. There was none.
Make it so, he told Defense.
We still haven't heard anything from Denver, Fowler said, rubbing his eyes.
I wouldn't expect much, General Borstein replied.
NORAD's command post is literally inside of a mountain. The entrance tunnel had a series of steel blast doors. The structures inside were designed to survive anything that could be aimed at them. Shock-absorbing springs and bags of compressed air isolated the people and machines from the granite floors. Overhead were steel roofs to stop any rock fragments that might be blasted free by a near miss. Borstein didn't expect to survive an attack. There was a whole regiment of Soviet SS-18 Mod 4s tasked to the destruction of this post and a few others. Instead of 10 or more MIRVs, they carried a single 25-megaton warhead, whose only plausible military mission was to turn Cheyenne Mountain into Cheyenne Lake. That was a pleasant thought. Borstein was a fighter pilot by trade. He'd started off in the F-100, called the Hun by its drivers, graduated from there to F-4 Phantoms, and commanded an F-15 squadron in Europe. He'd always been a tactical guy, stick and rudder, scarf and goggles, kick the tires, light the fires, first one up's the leader. Borstein frowned at the thought. Even he wasn't old enough to remember those days. His job was continental air defense, to keep people from blowing his country up. He'd failed. A nearby piece of America was blown up, along with his boss, and he didn't know why, or how, or who. Borstein was not a man accustomed to failure, but failure was what he saw on his map display.
General, a major called to him.
What is it?
Picking up some radio and microwave chatter. First guess is that Ivan's alerting his missile regiments. Ditto in some naval bases. Flash traffic outbound from Moscow.
Christ.
Borstein lifted his phone again.
Never done it?
Elliot asked. Strange but true, Borstein said. Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Russians never put their ICBMs on alert.
I don't believe it,
Fowler snorted.
Never?
The general's right, Ryan said. The reason is that their telephone system historically has been in pretty bad shape. I guess they've finally gotten it fixed enough.
What do you mean?
Mr. President, God is in the details. You send alert messages by voice. We do it that way, and so do the Soviets. The Russian phone system stinks, and you don't want to use a fluky system for orders of that importance. That's why they've been investing so much money in fixing it up, just as we have invested a lot in our command and control systems. They use a lot of fiber optic cable now, just like we do, plus a whole new set of microwave relays. That's how we're catching it, Jack explained. Scatter off the microwave repeaters.
Another couple of years, they'll be fully fiber optic and we wouldn't have known, General Fremont added.
I don't like this.
Neither do I, Ryan said. But we're at DEFCON 2 also, aren't we?
They don't know that. We didn't tell them that, Liz Elliott said.
Unless they're reading our mail. I've told you we have reports that they've penetrated our cipher systems.
NSA says you're crazy.
Maybe I am, but NSA's been wrong before, too.
What do you think Narmanov's mental state is?
As scared as I am, Ryan wondered.
Sir, there's no telling that.
And we don't even know if it's really him, Elliot put in.
Liz, I reject your hypothesis, Jack snapped over the conference line. The only thing you have to support it comes from my agency, and we have our doubts about it.
Christ, I'm sorry I ever took that report in, he told himself.
Cut that out, Ryan, Fowler snarled back. I need facts, not arguments now, okay?
Sir, as I keep pointing out, we do not as yet have sufficient information on which to base any decision.
Balls, the colonel next to General Fremont said.
What do you mean?
Sinksack turned away from the speakerphone.
Dr. Elliot is right, sir. What she said earlier makes sense.
Mr. President, they heard a voice say, we have a hotline transmission coming in.
President Fowler, we have just received a report that a U.S. Army unit in Berlin has attacked a Soviet unit without warning. Casualties are reported severe. Please explain what is happening.
Oh, shit, Ryan said, looking at the facts.
I need opinions, people, Fowler said over the conference line.
The best thing is to say that we have no knowledge of this incident, Elliot said. If we admit knowledge, we have to assume some responsibility.
This is a singularly bad time to lie, Ryan said forcefully.
Even he thought he was overdoing it.
They won't listen to you if you shout, Jack boy.
Tell that to Narmanov, Elliot shot back. They attacked us, remember?
So the reports say, but... Ryan, are you saying our people lied? Borstein snarled from Cheyenne Mountain.
No, General. But at times like this, the news is chancy, and you know that as well as I do.
If we deny knowledge, we can avoid taking a stand that we might have to back down from, and we avoid challenging them for the moment, the National Security Advisor insisted.
Why are they bringing this up now? She asked.
Mr. President, you used to be a prosecutor, Ryan said. You know how unreliable eyewitness accounts can be. Narmanov could be asking that question in good faith. My advice is to answer it honestly.
Jack turned to Goodley, who gave him a thumbs up.
Robert, we're not dealing with civilians. We're dealing with professional soldiers, and they ought to be good observers.
Narmanov is accusing us of something we didn't do, Elliot countered.
Soviet troops do not initiate combat operations without orders. Therefore, he must know that his accusation is false. If we admit knowledge, we will appear to admit his charge is true. I don't know what game he's playing, whoever that is at the other end of the line, but if we simply say we don't know what he's talking about, we buy ourselves time.
I strongly disagree with that, Jack said, as calmly as he could manage.
President Narmanov, as you know, I am mainly concerned with events within our own borders.
I have as yet no information from Berlin. Thank you for your inquiry. I just ordered my people to check into it.
Opinions?
The bastard's lying through his teeth, the defense minister said. Their communication system is too good for that.
Robert, Robert, why do you lie when I know you are lying?
Narmanov said, his head down. The Soviet president now had his own questions to ask. Over the past 2 or 3 months, his contacts with America had grown slightly cold. When he asked for some additional credits, he was put off. The Americans were insisting on full compliance with the arms reduction agreement, even though they knew what the problem was, and even though he'd given Fowler his word face to face that everything would be done. What had changed? Why had Fowler retreated from his promises? What the hell was he doing now?
It's more than just a lie. More than just this lie, the defense minister observed after a moment.
What do you mean?
He has emphasized again that his interest is in rescue of casualties in the Denver area, but we know he has placed his strategic forces on full alert. Why has he not told us of this?
Because he is afraid of provoking us, Narmanov asked. His words seemed rather hollow even to himself.
Possibly, defense admitted. But they do not know the success we've had reading their codes. Perhaps they think they have concealed this from us.
No, Kuropatkin said in his command center. I must disagree with that. We could hardly fail to see some of these indicators. They should know that we are aware of some aspects of their strategic alert.
But not all.
The defense minister turned to stare at Narmanov.
We must face the possibility that the American president is no longer rational.
The first time? Fowler asked. Elizabeth Elliot nodded. She was quite pale now. It's not widely known, Robert, but it is true. The Russians have never placed their strategic rocket forces on alert. Until now.
Why now? The president asked.
Robert, the only thing that makes sense is that it isn't Narmanov over there.
But how can we be sure?
We can't. All we have is this computer link. There's no voice link, no visual link.
Dear God.
Chapter 40. Collisions.
Ryan, how do we know it's really Narmanov over there?
Mr. President, who else would it be? God damn it, Ryan! You're the one who brought me the reports! Mr. President,
you have to settle down, Jack said in a voice that wasn't particularly calm.
Yes, I brought you that information, and I also told you it was unconfirmed. And I just told you a few minutes ago that we have reason to believe that it may not ever have been true at all. Can't you see your own data? You're the one who warned us that there might be some missing nukes, Elliot pointed out. Well, they turned up. They turned up here, right where we were supposed to be.
Christ, she's even more rattled than he is, Helen D'Agostino told herself. She traded a look with Pete Connor, who was pasty white.
This is going too fast. Look, Liz, I keep telling you that our information is too damn thin. We don't have enough to make any kind of informed judgment here. But why have they gone on nuclear alert?
For the same reason that we have, Ryan shouted back.
Maybe if both sides would back off.
Ryan, don't tell me what to do, Fowler said quietly. What I want from you is information. We make the decisions here.
Jack turned away from the speakerphone. Now he was losing it, Goodley thought. Now Ryan was pale and sick-looking. The deputy director of Central Intelligence stared out the windows at the CIA courtyard and the largely empty building beyond. He took a few deep breaths and turned back.
Mr. President, Jack said under taut control, our opinion is that President Narmanov is in control of the Soviet government. We do not know the origin of the explosion in Denver, but there is no information in our possession that would lead us to believe that it was a Soviet weapon.
Our opinion is that for the Soviets to undertake such an operation would be lunacy, and even if their military were in control. After a coup about which we have no information at all, sir, such a miscalculation is unlikely to the point of... The likelihood is so low as to approach zero, sir. That is CIA's position.
And Kadyshev? Fowler asked.
Sir, we have evidence just developed yesterday and today to suggest that his reports may be false. We cannot confirm one of the meetings that should...
One?
You can't confirm one meeting? Elliot asked.
Will you let me talk? Jack snarled, losing it again. Damn it, it was Goodley who did this work, not me.
He paused for a breath. Dr. Goodley noted some subtle differences in the nature of the reports and decided to check up on them. All of Kadyshev's reports supposedly came from face-to-face meetings with Narmanov. In one case, we cannot reconcile the schedules of both men. We cannot be sure that they met in that case at all. If they didn't meet, then Kadyshev is a liar.
I suppose you've considered the possibility that they met in secret? Elliot inquired acidly. Or do you think that a subject like this would be handled as a routine business matter? Do you think he'd be discussing a possible coup in a routine scheduled meeting?
I keep telling you that his information has never been confirmed. Not by us, not by the Brits, not by anybody.
Ryan, would you expect that a conspiracy leading to a military coup, especially in a country like the Soviet Union, would be handled in the utmost secrecy? Fowler asked.
Of course.
Then would you necessarily expect to have it confirmed by other sources? Fowler asked, talking like a lawyer in a courtroom.
No, sir, Ryan admitted.
Then this is the best information we have, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. President, if it's true.
You say that you have no firm evidence to confirm it.
Correct, Mr. President.
But you have no hard information to contradict it either, do you?
Sir, we have reasons.
Answer my question!
Ryan's right hand compressed into a tight white fist.
No, Mr. President. Nothing hard. And for the past few years he's given us good, reliable information?
Yes, sir.
So based on the record of Mr. Kadyshev, this is the best available information?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I suggest, Dr. Ryan, that you try to develop additional information. When you get it, I'll listen to it.
The line clicked off. Jack stood slowly. His legs were stiff and sore from the stress of the moment. He took one step to the window and lit a cigarette.
I blew it, he told the world.
Oh, Christ, I've blown it.
Not your fault, Jack, Goodley offered.
Jack spun around.
That'd look real good on my fucking tombstone, won't it? It wasn't his fault the fucking world blew up.
Come on, Jack, it's not that bad.
Think so? Did you hear their voices?
The Soviet carrier Kuznetsov didn't launch aircraft in the manner of U.S. carriers. Rather, it had a ski jump bow configuration. The first MiG-29 raced forward from its starting point and went up the angled ramp and into the air. This manner of takeoff was hard on pilots and aircraft, but it worked. Another aircraft followed, and both turned to head east. They'd barely gotten to altitude when the flight leader noted a buzz in his headphones.
Sounds like an emergency beeper on the guard frequency, he said to his wingman. Sounds like one of ours.
Duh, east-southeast. It is one of ours. Who do you suppose it is?
I have no idea.
The flight leader passed this information on to Kuznetsov and received instructions to investigate.
This is Falcon 2, the Hawkeye reported. We have two inbounds from the Ruski carrier, fast movers, bearing 315 and 250 miles from Stick. Captain Richards looked at the tactical display. Spade, this is Stick. Close and warn them off.
Roger, Jackson replied. He'd just topped his fuel tanks off. Jackson could stay up for another 3 hours or so, and he still carried 6 missiles. warn them off? Lieutenant Walters asked. Shredder, I don't know what's going on either. Jackson brought the stick around. Sanchez did the same, again splitting out to a wide interval. The two pairs of aircraft flew on reciprocal courses at a closing speed of just under 1,000 miles per hour. 4 minutes later, both Tomcats went active on their radars. Ordinarily, that would have alerted the Russians to the fact that American fighters were in the area, and that the area might not be totally healthy. But the new American radars were stealthy and were not picked up. It turned out that this didn't matter. A few seconds later, the Russians activated their own radar systems.
Two fighters coming in toward us!
The Russian flight leader checked his own radar display and frowned. The two MiGs were only supposed to be guarding their own task force. The alert had come in, and the fighters went up. Now he was on what might be a rescue mission and had no particular desire to play foolish games with American aircraft, especially at night. He knew that the Americans knew he was about. His threat receiver did detect the emanations from their airborne early warning aircraft.
Come right, he ordered, down to 1,000 meters to look for that beeper.
He'd leave his radar on, however, to show that he didn't wish to be trifled with.
They're evading to the left, going down.
Bud, you have the lead, Jackson said. Sanchez had the most missiles. Robbie would cover his tail. Stick, this is Falcon 2. Both inbounds are breaking south and diving for the deck. As Richards watched, the course vectors changed on both inbound aircraft. Their course tracks were not actually converging with the Roosevelt group at the moment, though they would be coming fairly close.
What are they up to?
Well, they don't know where we are, do they? The operations officer pointed out. Their radars are on, though.
Looking for us, then?
That would be my guess. Well, now we know where the other four came from. Captain Richards picked up the mic to talk to Jackson and Sanchez. Splash 'em, was the order. Robbie took high cover. Sanchez went down, pulling behind and below both MiGs.
I've lost the Americans. Forget them. We're looking for a rescue beeper, remember?
The flight leader craned his neck.
Is that a strobe light? On the surface, at 2 o'clock?
I have it.
Follow me down.
Evading, down and right, Bud called. Engaging now.
He was a bare 2,000 yards aft of the mix. Sanchez selected a sidewinder and lined his aircraft up on the south guy, the trailing wingman. As the Tomcat continued to close, the pilot got the warbling tone in his earphones and triggered off his missile. The AIM-9M sidewinder leaped off its launch rail straight into the starboard engine of the MiG-29, which exploded. Barely had that happened when Sanchez triggered off a second winder.
Splash one! What the hell?
The flight leader caught the flash out the corner of his eye and turned to see his wingman's aircraft heading down before a trail of yellow. He wrenched his stick left, his throttle hand punching the flare chase release button as his eyes searched the darkness for his attacker. Sanchez's second missile missed right. It didn't matter. He was still tracking, and the MiG's turn brought the target right into the path of his 20-millimeter cannon. One quick burst detached part of the MiG's wing. The pilot barely ejected in time. Sanchez watched the chute deploy. A minute later, as he orbited overhead, he saw that both Russians seemed to have survived the incidents. That was fine with Bud.
Splash two. Stick, we have 2 good chutes on the splashes. Wait a minute. There's 3 strobes down there, Jackson called.
He gave the position, and almost instantly a helicopter lifted off from Theodore Roosevelt.
Spade? Is it supposed to be this easy? Walters asked.
I thought the Russians were smarter than this myself, the captain admitted. This is like first day of duck season.
10 minutes later, Kuznetsov made a radio call for its 2 MiGs and got no reply.
The Air Force helicopter returned from Rocky Flats. Major Griggs alighted with 5 men, all of them dressed in protective gear. 2 of them ran to find Chief Callahan close to the M-728 engineer tanks.
10 more minutes if we're lucky, Colonel Lyle shouted from atop the lead tank.
Who's in charge here? One of the Nest team asked.
Who are you? Parsons, team leader. Lawrence Parsons was the head of the on-duty nuclear emergency search team, yet another failure for this day. Their job was to locate nuclear devices before they went off. Three such teams were kept on duty around the clock, one just outside Washington, another in Nevada, and the third, recently activated at Rocky Flats to help make up for the retirement of the Energy Department's weapons fabrication facility outside Denver. It had been anticipated, of course, that they wouldn't always be able to get there in time. He held a radiation counter in his hand and didn't like what he saw.
How long have your people been here?
About half an hour, maybe 40 minutes.
10 more minutes, I want everybody away from here. You're taking rims here, Chief.
What do you mean?
The Major said the fallout is all... What you're getting is from neutron activation. It's hot here.
Callahan cringed at the thought. His life was being attacked by something he couldn't see or feel.
There may be people inside. We're almost there. Then do it fast. I mean fast!
Parsons and his team started moving back to the helicopter. They had their own work to do. At the chopper, they met a man in civilian clothes.
Who the fuck are you?
Parsons demanded.
FBI. What happened here?
Take a guess.
Washington needs information. Larry, it's hotter here than it is at the stadium, another NEST team member reported.
Makes sense, Parsons said. Ground burst. He pointed.
Far side. Downwind side. In close was shielded some.
What can you tell me? The FBI agent asked.
Not much, Parsons said over the sound of the turning rotor.
Ground burst. Yield under 20 KT. All I got.
It's dangerous here?
Hell yes.
Set up. Where? Where?
How about at the Aurora Presbyterian Hospital? 2 miles upwind, a Nestor suggested.
Across from Aurora Mall. Ought to be okay there.
You know where that is? Parsons asked.
Yes. Then move out. Can you tell these people to get the hell out of here? It's 20% hotter here than in close. We have to get samples. Can you make sure they clear the area in 10 minutes? 15 max. Drag them out if you have to. Start here.
Right. The FBI agent ducked as the helicopter lifted off. The NEST team member began running down the line of fire trucks, waving for them to get away. The agent decided to do the same. After a few minutes, he got in his car and headed northeast.
Shit. I forgot about the neutrons, Major Griggs said. Thanks a lot, Callahan screamed over the sound of the tank.
It's okay. They cut it off at 100. 100 won't really hurt anybody. Callahan heard the sound of the engines pulling away.
What about the people inside?
The chief found the interphone at the back of the tank.
Listen up. We have 10 minutes and we gotta get the hell out of here. Lean on it.
You got it, man, the tank commander replied. Better get clear. I'll give you a 10 count. Callahan ran to the side. Colonel Lyle jumped off and did the same. Inside the vehicle, the driver backed off 10 yards, took the engine to the red line, and slipped the brake. The M-728 crushed 5 vehicles, slamming them aside. The tank was moving at perhaps a mile per hour, but it didn't stop. Its treads ripped up the asphalt. Then it was through. The area immediately next to the stadium structure was amazingly intact. Most of the wreckage from the roof and upper wall had been thrown hundreds of yards, but here there were only small piles of brick and concrete fragments. Too much for a wheeled vehicle, but clear enough that men could walk. Firefighters advanced and sprayed everything. The asphalt was still very hot, and the water steamed off it. Callahan ran in front of the tank, waving for his men to go left and right.
You know what this looks like? A NEST team member said as the helicopter circled the ruined stadium.
Yeah, Chernobyl. They had firemen there, too.
Parsons turned away from that thought.
Head downwind, he told the pilot.
Andy, what do you make this?
Ground burst. And this wasn't any 100 KT weapon, Larry. Not even 25.
What screwed up NORAD's estimate, do you think?
The parking lot.
Asphalt. Plus all those burning cars. It's the perfect blackbody material. It's even black, for God's sake. I'm surprised the thermal pulse didn't look bigger than that. And everything around here is white from the snow and ice, right?
They got a mega reflection plus a huge energy contrast.
Makes sense, Andy, Parsons agreed. Terrorists?
That's my bet for now, Larry. But we gotta get some residue to be sure.
The sounds of battle had died down.